You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, my name is David Bryan, and this is Curiosity Invited, a podcast inspired by endless curiosity. Tune in for an open-minded conversation about interesting and important things. Hello, and welcome to Curiosity Invited. I'm David Bryan, and today I am speaking with Britta Bushnell, the other person on the screen. I should tell you in advance, Britta and I know each other not well, but well, from working together years back. And Britta is, and I want to make sure I include everything there, Britta is a childbirth educator, a speaker, a mythologist, we will talk about that, and a relationship and parenting mentor, and this is that place where the book magically appears on the screen, and the author of Transformed by Birth. So that blue volume on over her, I don't know what shoulder it will look like, but that
I one, know, right? This yeah. one.
Right. So hi, Britta. Thanks for doing this. Thanks so much and welcome.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Did I also say she's a podcaster?
Oh,
no,
I am.
I didn't, yeah. But she is a podcaster. She has a podcast entitled the same thing as her book, Transformed by Birth. And so thanks again. Really
thank you for
it.
Having me. It's super fun and kind of full circle.
Oh, a mythologist.
So, yeah, what the heck?
What's a nice psychological person like you doing in a place like mythology? And what does mythology have to do with giving birth? What the hell's that about?
Oh God, isn't that the million-dollar question? It actually does not make sense. So first of all, I want to just acknowledge that in most places, it doesn't make sense. And often when I'm teaching childbirth classes, one of the first things I say after I do my introduction is, yeah, I have a PhD in mythology with an emphasis in psychology. And it may seem like that makes no sense for somebody teaching a childbirth class, but by the time we're done today, you'll get it. And you may even wonder, how can you teach childbirth classes without a PhD in mythology? Because childbirth is one of those places where your brain, your rational brain, your linear brain is not as online. But what is online is the part of our brain that can respond and remember stories, metaphors, symbols. And so in preparing for that experience, teaching through myth and story and fairy tale and symbols is sticky. I mean, to be fair, story is sticky in our memories, no matter whether we're in the middle of giving birth or or postpartum. It's true just as humans. I think there's the saying that we are story-making animals.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And so story is sticky for our memory, and it's even heightened when we are in that place where the hormonal bath of what's happening in labor, birth, and new parenthood provides us space for that, for mythology, in a way that like statistics and information and data just doesn't land.
And I'm so forgive me for asking this question, but is this based, is this proven by research as well? I mean, is it backed up by research as well that indeed the brain, the hormone bath, the chemical bath, absolutely changes in that direction so that, you know, I don't know if right brain, left brain is a fully accurate story anymore.
Right.
I mean, maybe it never was, but is it the case that neurochemically, endocrinologically, pregnant people, or are you saying more than
pregnant people? So let me respond in the best way I can. One, I am not a neuroscientist, so I want to just honor the fact that I don't have all of that.
You're not a neuroscientist who studies mythology?
Nope. I am a mythologist, and I understand how the stress, intensity of labor, as well as the intensity of oxytocin, in particular in labor, puts our brain into a different zone that is much more connected to, and this is, I'm going to say it, but it also is one of those places like left brain, right brain, but it's into that older brain. Mm-hmm. Or shall we say more of the reptilian brain, that place where it's not as, we're not as activated in the neocortex. So in that place where we've got, where we're hoping to allow the chemicals to release from the old brain, because that's what controls labor. Like the release of those hormones, as oxytocin is released, the contractions go up. That relationship happens in a way that helps labor function. Mm-hmm. So in a similar way to like sexual arousal, we know that the neocortex can get in the way. That sexual arousal is,
so for people who doesn't, right, that's the think,
the thinking brain, rational part of the
how
brain.
Do you spell that brain?
Yeah. Right. Yes. So that part of the brain is, you know, we know that we can, that the like sex drive, the desire to, the feeling of desire is one that is really instinctual from an old part of the brain. In the brainstem, and the neocortex can help infuse the desire for sexual engagement or reduce or hinder our desire for sexual engagement. This is true also in labor. So we can engage the neocortex in thinking and get activated in a way that then can make it so that we're like, labor can slow down. So if we get caught up in our thinking brain, it can be something that stirs stress hormones. Stress mm-hmm. hormones can come in and make it so that we're not as the hormones of labor aren't flowing as smoothly because our nervous system is not downregulated. It's not in that calm social nervous system state. So when coming back to the thoughts or the question that you had about, do we know that this is true?
Yeah.
It is understood that the brain holds on to images and storylines first. So when we are activating the mind in data, we aren't in labor. We're not necessarily engaged in that place of just calm and openness in our thought in the way that storytelling does, in the way that imagery does, and we can access that. Now, I can also tell you that through my experience with working with clients for the last 25 years, that the number of parents who come back to me after they've given birth and said, I didn't remember any of the statistics we talked about. None of them.
Right.
I don't remember anything that you said that involved a number. But the story of Inanna, I was Inanna.
So you made reference. So what is that story? Yeah.
So the story of Inanna.
Why did that help?
Pardon? What?
And why is that helpful to somebody?
So the story of Inanna is a long one. I mean, I do it across 2 days in my class, but I'll give you the cliff notes. Okay. So we'll do a cliff notes version. First of all, it's important to know that it's a Sumerian story. Inanna was a queen, and she was queen of heaven and earth. And many modern parents can often feel like they have the weight of the world and the heavens on their shoulders as they head into an experience like giving birth. She hears a call to the underworld. The underworld is often a place that represents the place of the unconscious or the unexperienced, the thing that we do not yet know. So she hears a call to the underworld, much like parents feel as they are called to new parenthood. Now, some people are called to new parenthood with the shocking pregnancy test, where it's like, oh, I guess I'm going to be a parent. And others are drawn to it like it's a call that has been echoing in their head for eons, like their whole life. So the difference in how we are called to the underworld is individual. But Inanna is called to the underworld, and she gets herself ready. She gathers all the things she thinks she needs, just like modern parents do as they prepare to become a parent. They get the class, they do all the various different classes, the different clothing, all of the things that they think they need. And then she starts her journey. And she starts her journey, and there are gates. There are gates to the underworld. And at each gate, the gatekeeper of the underworld takes something of value from her, stripping her down bit by bit by bit to the point where when she gets to the throne room of the underworld, which is where her sister, Erishkigal, lives, she has been stripped of her upper world accoutrement, shall we say. She is raw. She has become the journey itself. Her ego identity self of the upper world is gone, so that she is just this. And that is often what the journey of labor can feel like, where we come in with some upper world pride and excitement and readiness. And then we're like, wait, that's gone? Wait, I thought I'd really need that. Oh, wait, you're taking that too? But I thought I would be beautiful while I gave birth. I've seen all these videos on Instagram. What are you telling me that now I'm going to writhe and moan and howl and pee and poop? Like, what are you talking about? And so that feeling of stripping away of that which is the upper world self so that we can meet ourselves anew in the underworld is important, because what happens when Inanna enters the throne room is her sister looks on her with the eye of death, and in that moment she dies. And many parents can relate to the feeling when they look in the eye of their newborn child for the first time, that a part of them has died forever. It is one of those threshold moments where we say there's the time before I looked in those eyes, and then there's everything that starts after I've looked in those eyes.
And so, I didn't say this when I was introducing you, but what calls me to what had called me to your work as I dove in is that you speak about giving birth and the process of giving birth not only as, but as deeply as a spiritual transformation or an opportunity.
Yes.
For a transformation that is fundamental. In fact, I came across
it's a rite of passage.
Sacred initiation that remakes you fundamentally, and a rite of passage.
It's a rite of passage. And you meet yourself anew. And a lot of rites of passage research talks about it in the form of three phases. I mean, there's a bunch of different theorists, but one of the theorists that I like the best talks about it, Bruce Lincoln talks about it from looking at initiations given to young women only. And so his theory I like a lot for around childbirth, but he says stage one is enclosure. It's the going in, it's closing in some isolation in that. Stage two is metamorphosis. So his track, kind of the caterpillar to butterfly phase. And then stage three is the emergence.
Right.
Now, the person who coined the term rite of passage, he uses the separation, liminality, and reincorporation, which can also be a really good version. Yeah. But the story of Inanna tracks these. So there's the preparation and the journey down. Then there is the hanging on the hook. She's been, her upper world self has been stripped and she dies and is, her corpse is hung on a hook. And then there's her best friend and maidservant is waiting for her above ground. And when 3 days go by and she has not returned, Ninshubur does the things that are needed to help bring Inanna back. So she entrains the community. She bangs the drum, puts on the clothing of mourning, letting people know Inanna's gone. We need to go help her. Now, this is also a really important phase for parents in preparation for postpartum, is that who are the people that are going to bang the drum for you and help bring you back? Who's going to do
that? That is actually one of the things that came, that surfaced in my mind when reading through all that, is that there are a lot of people who make the decision to, well, some to give child, to have a child without a partner, right? I mean, just
absolutely
a single parent for sometimes involuntarily and sometimes voluntarily, and well, so what do those people do? How does that work?
Yeah, well, that is, I mean, it's a challenge to raise a child and go through labor, birth, and new parenthood with a partner.
Yeah.
And I would say it's challenging without a partner. How do you get support? Some people get support through extended family. Some people get support by paying people to be their support people. Some people get support by asking for support from their community. Now, we don't have, in the U.S. at least, a very well cohesive support system for new families.
Yeah.
We don't.
Well, I mean, and that relates back to, well, maybe why you wrote the book, or at least a piece of it. But you know, we've medicalized it, right? And it's a biological event. The whole thing is a series of biological events, and we know that the best people to get one through that, I'm being facetious somewhat, is the medical profession. And, you know, cause there's a voice, and I might have a corner of it myself, but there's certainly a voice in the culture that is, well, why the big to do? Human beings have been doing this for a very long time. Thank you very much. In fact, look, we've taken over the whole freaking planet, and you know, we're spreading like wildfire. And so what's the big deal? Isn't this just natural? And we've sort of stripped away all of the, as much of, like in many areas, we've stripped away much of the mythology, much of the storytelling around it, much, right? I mean, we've
absolutely
the facts. We just want the facts.
Absolutely. I mean, it is as quote unquote natural, and we've been experiencing it since the beginning of time in a similar way that we have adolescence or menopause. But that doesn't mean that those passages, like through adolescence, like through menopause or midlife, or what the term that is being used these days for this journey that I'm talking about is matrescence, which is the transition.
Say it again. Of
matrescence.
Matrescence.
Like adolescence.
Ah, matrescence.
Matrescence.
Yeah.
Yeah. So matrescence is like adolescence. It's a full life transformation. Mm-hmm. So going into becoming a parent, where it's a really primary part of your life, it will influence every aspect of your being. It changes your body. It changes your relationship to work. It changes your relationship to the word family. I can remember before I had my first, if I said to a friend, I'm going to spend the weekend with my family, that meant my parents and siblings.
And there's a lot of them.
And there are a lot of them on both fronts. Yes. There are a lot. I have 7 siblings. And then after I had a child, if I said, I'm going to spend the weekend with my family, that meant something completely different.
Right.
That meant I was spending the weekend with my husband and my son, mm-hmm. or then my other son as well, once he was born. So the matrescence impacts all aspects of our life, our spiritual, our emotional, our creative. It takes time for those changes to land in our psyche and settle. But when we think about giving birth, we're like, oh, that's like a one-day thing. Like you do it, you come out, boom, you're done. Well, that's kind of a dentist perspective. And not a rite of passage perspective. And I think it actually is a disservice.
Can I get a temporary filling?
Yeah. It is a disservice to parents and families who are navigating a profound rite of passage to hold a perspective that it's like going to the dentist.
Okay, so do you walk into a, well, have you crafted your life so that you walk into a room full of people, whatever the context, and you start to say what you, similar things to what you have said, and they look at you like, what the hell are you talking about? Or people know it right away. How's that work?
I would say for the most part, it depends. One, have they had children themselves? Because that perspective tends to be more in a place of, oh, you're speaking what you're putting words, you're putting words to what I already know.
Yes. Yeah.
And there are definitely those folks, especially those who went into birth and new parenthood thinking that having a child on the other side would be like having a really cool accessory that now moves through the world with them. That when the reality of that accessory not being an accessory but a human became true for them, where it was like, oh, this is big. A lot is required of me. And this isn't just about that child, but it's about me.
Yeah. I don't even know how big this is. I don't even know what's required of me.
Right. That when those folks can be incredibly initiated. It can be kind of a hard or rough initiation into parenthood for those who had an expectation that it would be this accessory to their life. And then they go, wow, this really changed me. That's hard. That can be a harder initiation. And so a lot of them, I like to plant some of the metaphors, the stories, the idea of it as a rite of passage. I have a bunch of symbols that I use as well. I like to plant those ahead of time.
I was going to say, before anybody gets there.
Yeah, because then they've got scaffolding.
Yeah.
To hold up their experience that they're having in a way that helps create meaning, understanding, and self-compassion.
And do you work with, I know you teach classes, do you work with people who, right? I mean, here's my fantasy, knowing nothing. Here's my fantasy is, in the perfect world, people find you when they get the pregnancy test as positive. Ooh, we better prep. And they find you and they get to sail through this process, and you've secretly or not so secretly implanted the scaffolding, and they go through and they're ready for a transformation because they know that's what's coming, and they are eyes fully open. But a lot of people don't do that. Do you work with people who, you know, they come in because they've just gone through something,
yes,
their hair's flown back, they have,
yes,
holy shit, I need some help.
Yes, both. I mean, and I work also with other professionals in this field to help empower them in some of these tools that I use, some of these ancient technologies is sometimes how I refer to them, and so that they can then use them with their clients as well.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, I work with couples. So one of the things that I do, I mean, I had a group of older women who decided that they wanted to read my book as part of their book club. And then they invited me to come to this book club. And I was like, All right, this sounds interesting.
Really?
And the number of them that found healing, and these were women in their 70s and 80s, who found healing reading my book that dates back to their birth-giving experience was pretty high. And there were tears. There were elements of like, wow, this really gave me a new perspective. So that's the oldest group that I've worked with. But a lot of times I see folks right after they've given birth or within that first year. So I would say in the early postpartum period, which in my book is really in that whole first year.
Mm-hmm.
And they're needing to understand what has changed. What has happened?
I know the book, your book, has big chunks of it that is about I don't remember what words you've used, but I think it's like ideals, like,
yes,
things that people that they have learned in the culture about how it's supposed to be, all along the way. And that the book tries to at least loosen their hold on that, right? Not necessarily give it up, but loosen their, you know, there is a right way to do this,
right,
and then there's all these wrong ways. So you better get it right. And
my book actually, in many ways, came out of my research for my doctoral dissertation. So I went into grad school thinking I was going to write my dissertation on anything but birth. Like, that was my plan. And instead, of course, I ended up writing my dissertation on birth. And I wrote about the ways, in many ways, we could call them the cultural myths. So those stories or ideals that we hold that are so prevalent in our lives and in our culture or the overculture or society, whatever word you want to use, that we don't even notice them. It's like the water to the fish.
Sure.
And so what I was trying to do was be a fish that's in that water and look around and try and explain and name the water. So I named in the book 8 cultural ideals. And these really, they impact parents in birth. And they're really applicable for us to look at no matter whether we're giving birth or not. And so I'll just rip through them really fast if you want.
I was about to say, maybe rip through what they are, but then pick one or two and dive a little deeper.
Okay. So 1 and 8 are really good ones to talk about because they're the bookends and they relate to each other. So number 1 is the desire for control and the need for certainty.
Okay,
that's that illusion of control. Number two is the veneration of information and technology, the idea that if we just get the right information or the right technology, we can control things. Mm-hmm. In many ways, all of them kind of zip back up to that illusion of control.
Yeah.
The third one is about the reverence for ordered culture rather than wild nature. So the idea that the preference we have for order, and which again connects to control, but it's like we like our to-do lists. We don't like to just move through the day. We don't trust that just moving through the day on our own energy and vibe, shall we say, will get us anything done. That's we tend to have a desire to climb and achieve. The fourth one is a vilification of pain. So that is the one that says pain is a villain that needs to be tackled, not something that we experience as part of our human existence. And I believe that pain is part of being human, and it has things to teach us. That doesn't mean that I think you should not get the epidural or not use the Tylenol. No. But the vilification of pain kind of plays into how we show up in parenthood a lot, and definitely in labor and birth. Five is the glorification of independence, the idea that if we can do something alone, we should. We are hyper-individualistic and independence-driven rather than collective, community-based entities. And I think that works against us, especially in new parenthood. Six is the adherence to innocence. I don't need to know that. I don't want to know. I don't want to know. Innocence is bliss. We even talk about innocence is bliss. So why would I want to look at anything that's out there? Let's not do that. Number seven is the denial of death. The idea that we should, in whatever ways we can, avoid death, hide it, put it in nursing homes and outside the bounds of common conversation. So much so that when parts of our identity die, we think something's wrong. And then the last one is the quest for perfection and exceptionalism. And that one is...
definitely relates to the first one.
It relates to the first one. Yeah. So those two are really the bookends for all of them that kind of send the energy of, oh, everything's supposed to be perfect. And if it isn't perfect, if it doesn't go the way that I want it to, then I had a failed initiation. Without understanding that actually things not going the way we want them to is an inherent part of initiation. It's an inherent part of a rite of passage to be out of control, to face the unexpected, to have things go sideways. Those are inherent, not things we're supposed to be trying to avoid.
No.
I barely gave my kids any medicine when they were super little. And then my firstborn was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. It's well, wait a second. What do I do now? Did this pop my illusion of perfection, my illusion of control? Absolutely. I mean, it had popped before that, if I'm being really clear.
It was the first time you didn't do anything perfectly.
Right. But it was one of those really life... one of the things that parenthood often teaches us is the openness to the unbidden. Mm-hmm. How do we face the unbidden? And we choose our partners, we choose our friends, we often choose our careers, we choose what we read before we go to bed at night. There's all these places where we're like, I'm going to choose. But our children, we don't get to choose them. They come and they teach us stuff that we did not have on our to-do list.
That's right. That's right.
In really profound ways.
So how much of what you do sort of moves from giving birth being pregnant and giving birth to parenting, to being a parent.
So it's interesting that you ask that, because one of the things that I often hear from the expectant parents who take my class is they said, wow, I thought I was coming to a childbirth class. And instead I realized I'm taking away life 101. Because so much of, in many ways, childbirth has just been the vehicle to meet people and help explore the idea of change, transformation, rite of passage. So it's, we do this, we go through rites of passage over and over again in our lives. And so when you can learn and embrace and have symbols and stories and metaphors and myths to help be part of your companions through those changes and transformations in our lives, it really helps us in the future ones that we have. Here I am, I'm postmenopausal now, and I'm in what is often referred to as the midlife transformation or midlife essence, like adolescence. There's Chip Conley calls it middlescence. I'm like, I often find that funny because I don't expect to live to 112, but okay, middle of life, sure.
I absolutely do.
Do you? Okay. But I am going through a rite of passage right now in my life. And what I know about rites of passage from the work that I've done with new families is absolutely applicable to what I'm navigating in my life now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it continues. And I think that a lot of the skills that we need to navigate big changes, everybody needs, not just new parents. I just rope them in thinking they're getting a childbirth class.
The partners, they're not pregnant. Right.
They're not, but their lives but are pregnant. That their life is changing too.
Yeah. Okay.
And they're changing now. Do they experience it often in a different way? Absolutely. One of the things that I just spoke with a fatherhood expert for my podcast recently, and he speaks about them going through a transformation experience as well. And in my experience working with dads, and I'll just talk about dads for a second. So when I'm working with dads, they are also, it's like their toes are perched on the edge of a cliff or a precipice, and they can feel that there is a cavern below them. They feel it. Now, often what happens is where somebody who's pregnant might get into sort of an uber nesting, like I want to make the house and my space and that kind of thing can often show up for the one who's pregnant. I would say often for dads, I see uber provider activated. And now it's not super cut and dry and gendered and all of that, but there is this energy of, oh, wow, it's not just about me. And then there also, the other thing that I see is because I deal with fears a lot in my work, and we shine a light on them rather than just being like, no, there's no fears. We're not afraid. That doesn't do anybody any good. So we actually look at fears, and a lot of the fears that partners have is, will I be a good parent? Sure. And it tends to come from a place of, will I live up to, say it's a dad, will I live up to being like the dad that I had? Or
not.
How do I not do fathering the way that my father did?
Right.
And I would say it's probably like 25-75, where some are like, I want to be like my dad, and about
and the 75
three quarters is the how do I not repeat what I got, and that feels really potent, because parents today, dads, partners are a lot as expected of them. When I was born, you know, it was a big deal that my dad was in the room when my mom gave birth to me. It was unusual. Or even the generation before that, my grandfather was smoking cigars. when my grandmother was giving birth.
Right.
That wasn't, he wasn't there right. when it happened.
Right.
But now we are asking partners to be in the room, be a good support person, advocate on our behalf, rub our feet well, know what to do, be an excellent parent, show up, be present, be loving, you know, have their shit together, have a career that is thriving. All of those. It's like, it is, woo, it is a lot.
And don't get offended when I scream at you as I'm giving birth.
Yeah. And you have to do all of this without me telling you what to do.
Right. Right.
And not only do you have to do it without telling me what, without me having to tell you what to do, if I get mad at you, you have to not take it personally.
Right. Exactly.
So we've asked a lot of partners in a very short time distance.
Yeah. I remember the clue for me was, especially after I was there was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And was if I say this, how many years of therapy am I guaranteeing that person? If that comes out of my mouth, what am I saddling this person with?
Yeah. Well, and therein lies what's happening today that is so challenging. And I have a great amount of empathy for myself and other parents, is that illusion of perfection. That yeah. If we really, we believe so strongly that parenting matters, we know a lot about the impact of parenting. And while it does matter, we are human. And right. perfection actually bites us in the butt.
Right.
Striving for perfection does not work. It doesn't.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, making some mistakes gives you the opportunity to apologize, which is such an important thing for young people, well, and for anybody to hear. It's like, I am genuinely sorry.
Yeah.
For having said that, done that, you know, judged you in this or that way, whatever. So, okay.
The Absolutely.
The other piece of this is, where does the medical profession fit in? How much of the facts that are deemed so important matter a big deal, matter a lot? How do you make sense of that? How does a person make sense of that when they're going through the process?
Yeah, well, and this, I'm gonna take this a slightly different way than I think you're intending, but one of those ideals was that adherence to innocence. And I think that's the process of maturation through having a baby is really important. And part of the journey of becoming a parent is learning how to advocate, learning how to have a voice, learning how to not just be in, I mm-hmm. use an image called the turning of the family wheel, where there's the seat of the child, there's the seat of the parent, and there's the seat of the grandparent. Now, there can be more seats, but in the basics, it's that. Many of us arrive in parenthood having spent our whole life with our butt in the seat of the child, receiving information from parents and authority figures and everybody telling us what to do.
Mm-hmm.
And when we become a parent, we have to take a walk from the seat of the child into the seat of the parent, which is at the apex of this circle. And in that seat of the parent, we get to make decisions. We get to ask for what we want. We get to make decisions about the care and advocacy and birth and going through the process with our healthcare team, whether it is OBs or specialists of the Western medicine model or more of a midwife or somebody else. We still have to take ourselves up to the seat of the parent and advocate for ourselves and our child.
Mm-hmm.
And that process is an important part of the journey mm-hmm. of becoming a parent, because you're going to have to do it, as you know, with care providers and educators and teachers and tutors and coaches and nannies and yeah. you name it. For yeah. your entire life as a parent.
And neighbors and the kids.
That's right.
Friends, and friends' parents.
And friends' parents. You're going to do it until your child learns how to do it for themselves. And right. it's our job as parents to role model it and then start to step out of the way.
Yeah. Yeah.
And let them begin to do it more for themselves. So that when then, if they decide to become a parent, their butt's not so situated in that seat of the child that mm-hmm. says, tell me what to do. Mm-hmm. Tell me what to do. We have a overculture that is pretty much, preferences the place of tell me what to do. Tell me sure. how to do it right. rather than that innate checking in. What matters to me? What's right for my family? Let me gather the information from experts and books and podcasts and wherever that information may be, and then use my intuition to process it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, this is really unfortunate, but I'm looking at the time, and that's wild. And I wish there was much more time, and maybe there will be. But before you go, is there a next? And if there is a next, or a redo, would you do it differently? Would you write a different book?
There are aspects of my book I would change, sure. I mean, one of the things that I learned writing my dissertation is that a done dissertation is a good dissertation. Like that was the mantra I had to get through in order to get my doctorate. And I had to pull some of that with my book, because the illusion of control and the quest for perfection impacts me too.
Yeah.
And so I was trying to, I'm going to get the book just right. Well, if I waited till the book was just right, it never would be published. So of course there are anybody who thinks that they got it just perfect, and dotted all the I's and crossed all the T's. And, I still find typos in my book, and it went through copy edits and, my publisher and you name it. I read it out loud for the audio, the whole thing. And there are typos that we did not catch. Mm. And so there's an element of course there's things I would change.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And there's more to come. I want to work on something that's specifically for parents who are growing their family after having the first baby, because having subsequent babies are different types of rites of passage.
Mm, that's interesting. See, there's not nearly enough time to have the conversations that need to be had. So perhaps we'll do this again. You never know. Yeah. But I will make sure that all the information that is how to get in touch with you, how to take a look at what you offer, et cetera, the book itself is in the liner notes and maybe even flashing on the screen. The cover of the book right now will appear once again on the screen.
Love it.
So good.
Thank you.
So good. Britta, thanks so much. Thanks so much for doing this. I really do appreciate
Thank
it.
Thank you, David. It's really full circle. I can't believe you hired me so many years ago, and here we are.
What was I thinking? I was intuitively knowing it was a brilliant move.
You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.